This is Once for All, where Jude 3 says, I found it necessary to write appealing to you to contend for the faith that was once for all delivered to the saints. Listen in as the faith held by believers of all times is now delivered to you.
As we are wont to do on Fridays on Once for All, we check out what is going on in the news and comment a little bit about it. And we just scrape the bottom of the barrel so you can help us out with that. And today it's Jeff Smith. Jeff, welcome back to Once for All.
That's quite the introduction. Thank you.
Well, as we should let the listeners know how they can contact us if they want to chime in during today's broadcast. We have perspectives on these news items. I try to take the Christian worldview perspective. You take the more political perspective. But our listeners might have another perspective, and that is welcome. The toll-free number is 1-844-51-FAITH. We are coming to you live this Friday morning, February the 16th. You can also email me, and I will read your email on the air. DeliveredOnceForAll@gmail.com. DeliveredOnceForAll@gmail.com. Well, you know, it's one of those things, Jeff, that unfortunately we don't really like covering on Fridays. It's another shooting. And I think we've probably, since you and I have been doing this a little over a year, we've probably covered this story in some form or another a couple times already. And so, it's a sad thing that we have to keep talking about, and it's inevitable that it will happen again someday. This isn't going to be the last school shooting or a mass shooting, by any stretch of the imagination. But it's hard not to at least mention it. As we every week look at what stories we're going to cover, when you have such a big thing in the news, to not mention it, to me almost seems heartless, to say that we're thinking about the families and the victims, who came in. Now there's always maybe a slightly different perspective on this, both from a Christian worldview perspective and a political perspective. I have to admit, I probably shouldn't admit this, saying that we're going to be covering this, but I actually haven't, consumed a lot of the facts and details about the story. I try not to get sucked into that so much because it's really the same every time. You know, they dig into the person's background, they find some red flags that someone should have been paying attention to. The gun debate usually comes up, and it's just kind of this. And I don't know. I get worn out by that kind of news cycle of these things. So my commentary will much be more general than specific. But I want to give it to you first. Any thoughts, remarks about everything that's been coming out in the news in the last couple days?
Well, the thing that bothers me with when these stories come up is a few things happen, and you kind of touched on a few of them, is that, of course, immediately the gun debate comes to life again, and I don't think any of us have the answers for how to prevent any of this, because you can't prevent any of it. In fact, even with some of the horrible school shootings that we've had in the past, many years, the largest loss of life in an attack on a school was actually done with dynamite, and it was done in the early 20th century. So the parts of the gun debate that come up each time, they ring a little hollow, because if we could magically make all the guns disappear in America, which would be a tall task for sure. Even the gun buyback that happened in Australia, that a lot of the anti-gun advocates will point to, they were only able to round up about a third of the guns. They know that about two thirds are still out there, and gun crime hasn't stopped in Australia. They like to point to numbers and say that the buyback has worked, but the decrease in gun crime is actually at a higher rate in the United States than it is in Australia. Mm-hmm. So while I would love to entertain some of the things that people want to talk about, many of the laws that they describe are already on the book and already being broken by some of the people that are involved in these shootings. So it's a discussion definitely to have, but the hyperbole and the some of the things that get said. And then the media doesn't help with this, because they'll report things like that there's been, you know, 33, I don't remember the number now, I don't have it in front of me, but, you know, school shootings already this year. And you scratch your head and go, I don't remember hearing about that many. Well, that's because they're counting things like a window in an empty school is shot out, a drunk happens to stumble his way onto, again, empty school grounds and shoots himself, or again shoots out windows of the school. They're counting those as school shootings. Well, that's not what we're talking about here. And the thing that bothers me is that school shootings are bad enough, and the number we're having is bad enough. When you try and inflate the numbers to make it sound worse, you're actually hurting your cause, because you're starting to become the little girl that cried wolf type of situation, where it's kind of like the global warming debate. If we want to have a real debate about man's effect on the climate, it's a little hard when one side has been caught cheating in the numbers over and over again. It's hard to feel like you're getting an honest conversation. And so the media kind of is failing us in that respect, that they want to sensationalize, you know, things to a higher level than what they really are. And the actual school shootings are bad enough. We don't need to inflate our horrible past. It's bad enough on its own. And I guess the other thing that gets brought up each time with one of these, and I don't know that it's a really the way that we should look at these things, is they've got to find a reason why this shooter would do this. They really did that heavily with the Las Vegas shooting, and really to no avail.
Right.
They've really not been able to dig up anything significant to say, oh, this is why he did it. So I'm not sure that that's a healthy exercise, to go hunting for the exact reason. Clearly, these people are all mentally ill. If you're willing to take the lives of innocent people on a mass scale, or even just an individual, clearly there's a level of mental illness. Now, what might be a little bit different in this case, and not different altogether, because we've had other cases like this, this person, they knew there was a problem there. Now, the question is, what can they do about it? Now, the FBI was notified when apparently this same individual had made a comment on a blogger's site. I don't know. I think it was a video blog, and he had made a comment that he wanted to be a professional school shooter. Well, he has an interesting or a different way of spelling his first name that's maybe not the most common way to spell it. And the FBI basically said they weren't able to get to the bottom of that. Well, how many people do you have to look into just on a cursory basis to find the one that matches this? He used his own name, and he spelled it right, properly, the way that he spells it, which is an unusual spelling. I don't buy it. So, again, we have another case where I think the FBI may have let us down. But having said that, what really can they do?
Right.
Until someone, again, and it's a sad commentary, but until somebody actually does something illegal, you can't just haul them in. Now, if you think that they could be held on a mental health hold, you know, that's something to look at. And there's a lot of facts in this case that show this guy should have been on law enforcement radar, and was on law enforcement radar. And unfortunately, this one slipped through the cracks. And, you know, we definitely have conversations we need to have, but they need to be from an honest place. And we just don't get that from the media and from some of the special interest groups on either side.
You know, this is always the toughest part of the conversation, I think, is how are we proactive with those who would be disturbed enough to do something like that, and still have due process in our country, which the Constitution affords the citizens. You know, just yesterday in our own state of Oregon, the House just passed a bill that was supposedly supposed to close the so-called boyfriend loophole. So as it stood, or as it stands today, I should say, if a family member of your house reports you to be, you know, deranged or to having problems, then you could be reported and your guns could be, you know, taken away for that. And there was a so-called boyfriend loophole that if, say, you know, a couple never got married but they're living together, well, now it's just a boyfriend and not a member of the household. So now, you know, that person doesn't count. So they try to close that. But they expanded the areas of concern for, like, someone who's been accused of stalking and things like this. And we're broadening these areas of concern, but we have to be careful that we don't do so by taking away someone's due process. You know, there was just a story recently of a man out of Bend who was accused of, I think, stalking or sexual harassment or something like that. And he had to fight it in court, but he was finally deemed to be not guilty. Well, he went through the process. He had his due process and was found not guilty. But according to the gun laws, his guns could have been confiscated at the beginning of that process. And so he lost his rights to guns without having his day in court first. Now, what do we do? I mean, on the one hand, we need to protect people's rights, including the Second Amendment rights. But we also can't be taking those things away without the proper process. And so that's where it becomes very, very difficult. There's always different angles to take this from a Christian worldview perspective. Usually the question is a question of theodicy. Why does God, you know, let these things happen? And we just have to come back and say, we don't know. You know, anytime we come up with some kind of an answer to that question, why would God allow this to happen? Why would God let an evil person shoot up innocent people? We don't know why God would allow that to happen. But, you know, it's interesting to me that's oftentimes the first question we go to, that we want to, we'll say, well, why, what's God doing? And maybe the question that we should be asking is, what are we doing? I mean, where is man at fault in all of this? And I had a guest on yesterday on this program that was talking about evolution and the mind change that evolution has had amongst us. And, you know, he said we teach our children that they come from apes, and then we wonder why they act like apes. And that's a bit of an example. Say, look, evolution says that there is really no meaning or purpose to life. And so really it should be a pursuit of your own desires and pleasures, whatever makes yourself feel good. But there's no call for loving the neighbor, caring for another person, throwing yourself in the path of bullets to save another person's life. The evolutionary process would actually condemn that perspective, because now you're putting yourself among the weakest rather than amongst the strongest. So he was making the assertion, and I was starting to, you know, really agree with him that our prominent teaching of evolution today is changing our worldview to think, you know, there's nothing worth really sacrificing one for another, loving one another, that we're all in it for ourselves. And there's nothing to really stop, at least from the worldview perspective, to say these things shouldn't happen. That has to come from a perspective of morality or ethics to say that shouldn't happen.
Well, and that you bring up an interesting point, and I would take it to another Christian worldview that I think is the crux of why in situations like this the guns get blamed. You know, in no other instance of mass death, like car accidents or other, you know, man-made deaths, do we blame the instrument. But in the case of guns, they immediately go to blaming the instrument. And I think it's a denial of a Christian worldview that man is inherently evil. They want I think people forget how big that distinction is, that so many people think that oh, well man is good, and so that's, it's an easy step to go, well, since man is good, let's blame the guns. The guns are at fault here. And so, you know, it's another Christian worldview, I think, that really becomes the dividing line between the two sides. And I don't think people see it that way necessarily, but that's how I see it.
Sure. No, I agree with you. You know, to go back to the gun debate, I guess, you made a great point. You know, I remember when the Newtown shooting happened, I think I've mentioned this before on the air. Everyone was screaming gun control and stuff. But that very same week in China, a man walked into a elementary school with a hammer and was hitting people in the head with hammer. And I don't remember the numbers, but it was a comparative number of injury and death to Newtown at the time. Or when the, you know, Boston marathon bombing took place, I was expecting people to come out and talk about pressure cooker control, but you didn't hear that discussion. And so, I think you make a great point that we're trying to impute the sins of people onto guns, and thinking by getting rid of guns we're getting rid of evil, but we have to remember that it's man that is born into sin. Man will always be doing evil things, and they'll use whatever tools they can find to carry out their evil desires. That's just the reality of the world we live in post Adam and Eve. So,
yeah, the largest mass killing in our country was perpetrated with box cutters and airplanes. So there's definitely a discussion to be had. I don't want anyone to think that, you know, immediately the right, we just dismiss any discussion. We just dismiss the irrational discussion that generally comes. But again, yeah, the evil is the underlying problem. And I think that society too often is looking for some other reason. You know, they don't want to admit that the evil is there.
Yeah, indeed. Well, let's take a break and we'll be right back. You're listening to Once for All.
The phone lines are now open. Call toll-free 1-844-51-FAITH. That's 1-844-51-FAITH.
With SRN News, I'm Keith Peters in Washington. Thousands of people attended a vigil for the 17 victims of a school shooting in Florida this evening. The vigil Thursday night began with a moment of silence for those slain at the school in Parkland. Audible sobs rose from the crowd as the names of victims were read. Dressed in the school's colors, some held flowers while others wielded signs asking for action to fight school violence, including gun control. Meanwhile, the teenager accused of using a semi-automatic rifle to massacre 17 people at that Florida high school confessed to carrying out one of the nation's deadliest school shootings and carried extra ammunition in his backpack. Nicholas Cruz told investigators that he shot students in the hallways and on the grounds of Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, north of Miami. On Wall Street, the Dow up by 307 points. The NASDAQ rose 113. More on these stories at srnnews.com.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, president of Life Issues Institute.
This issue has been brewing for years in Ireland. Currently, abortion isn't allowed unless there's a risk to the mother's life. But should pro-abortion activists get their way and revoke Ireland's Eighth Amendment protecting life, abortion will likely be available on demand through 12 weeks and beyond under certain conditions. Sadly, the Irish Prime Minister came out strongly in favor of abolishing protections for the nation's unborn babies. He claims the current law will criminalize our sisters, our co-workers, and our friends. Some of George Soros's billions has already funded the pro-abortion effort, and it will likely attract millions more from Planned Parenthood and the like. Please pray the babies in Ireland will continue to be protected. The vote will be held in May.
Follow us on Twitter at Life Issues USA and stay informed, more informed than you've ever been.
his foreword to Lucas Woodford's book, Great Commission, Great Confusion, or Great Confession, Dr. Harold Sinkbeil cautions us against the desperate efforts of market-style evangelism and reminds us what the church really ought to be about. He writes, "Desperation breeds innovation. When it dawns on churches that they are losing headway in terms of numerical growth, panic ensues. We've got to do something, they cry. Here's something. Let's do it. In the name of contextualizing the gospel, it would appear almost anything goes. Methods from the entertainment and sales industries have been widely adapted, adopted, and imported, but to little or no avail. Statistically, the church, especially in North America, seems to be in decline. The key to the church's vitality for the looming post-Christian era is the same as it was in the pre-Christian era. Doctrinal clarity coupled with corresponding faithful practice." That was Harold Sinkbeil for today's Takedown Minute.
With an SRN News Business Brief, I'm Wally Hines. The Securities and Exchange Commission rejected the sale of the Chicago Stock Exchange to a group led by China-based investors. The agency says there are unresolved questions about the ownership structure under such a deal and whether the SEC would have sufficient oversight of the exchange if it was sold. Amtrak's top executives considering suspending service on tracks that don't have sophisticated speed controls by a December 31st deadline. This is a push to strengthen safety after a series of deadly wrecks. Richard Anderson has told a House panel that Amtrak is worried passengers are being put at risk by delays in installing positive train control systems on tracks it uses but doesn't own. The EPA has drastically lowered a fine on agribusiness company Syngenta for violations of pesticide regulations. Under the settlement, Syngenta will pay $150,000 for improperly using pesticide at a cornfield in Hawaii. The original fine was $4.9 million. With business, I'm Wally Hines.
And we're back on Once for All. You know, the moment you start redefining what the difference between a man and a woman is, male and female is, it's going to start affecting many other things. And the story next is a case in point. New York City school cancels father-daughter dance over gender-neutral policy. Basically, I'll just give a synopsis. This Staten Island school had a tradition of having a father-daughter dance, but people complained because it was not all-inclusive of all other genders, and so the school just decided to cancel the dance, of course disappointing fathers and daughters everywhere. The line is from one of the girls, says, "I've got my shoes, I've got my dress, I'm ready to go, but couldn't go to the dance." So that's the basic premise of the story. If you have any other details, feel free to bring them up. But you know, this is the problem that that we're seeing. That we think as a society, we think that we can redefine what gender is. That we can say that gender is some sort of a social construct, and so we're not going to, we're going to have non-binary definitions of gender and all of this kind of a thing. And now we're, and you know, add to that just the meltdown of the family unit, you know, I mean, that we're almost shaming people for having a mom and a dad and children, you know, the basic, you know, family, and you know, you're not, stepping in line with our new perspective of non-binary gender to say you have a mom and a dad. I mean, this is how ridiculous it's being. So when we start redefining these basic intrinsic truths of humanity, that there is such a thing as a male and there is such a thing as a female, and those two things are different from one another and uniquely different from one another, when we start denying that basic primal truth, throws the rest of society, what we do and how we function, out of whack. And so something probably as beautiful as a father-daughter dance, you know, where a daughter can go to a dance with dad, and this is, you know, as a young girl would go on a date or go on a dance with dad, she's learning a lot about what dating should look like when she gets older. She's learning a lot about what a man should do on a date and things like this. And we're completely cutting this off at the knees, all because of political correctness. What was your thought on this story?
Well, I think your last point is probably the most important point about this, is that the purpose of the dance has there are some specific purposes, and this whole gender neutral society movement is ignoring the fact that, again, and we've talked about it on this show over and over again, here's a newsflash: there are men, there are women, there are fathers, there are mothers. Why do we have to pretend that those things don't exist in order? I understand inclusivity, but there's other dances, there's other events. I mean, are they going to have to quit having wheelchair basketball games because I don't have a wheelchair, I can't participate? That's ridiculous. It's a stupid thing to say, but here I am saying it because we're in this, you know, this position where everything that we ever do has to be all inclusive. Well, no, it doesn't. I don't have to hire someone in my business that wants to sit on the couch all day and drink beer. I'm not going to pay a guy to sit in his, you know, in his own living room and drink beer. He's going to have to show up on time, and he's going to have to know something about the business and do the work. And I don't even have to train someone. Maybe I want to hire someone with experience, but this idea of all inclusive, it's ridiculous, and it's not healthy. It's not. I kind of take it back to the fact that, you know, we have a lot of young people that feel entitled. They and I think this adds to that. Well, I have to be included. I'm important. No, you're included when you fit into whatever it is that we're doing. If you're a boy, you don't get to be included in girls' sports because boys are generally stronger, faster. You know, maybe not at middle school age. There's a little bit of catching up to be done there. But in general, there's a reason we separate into groups. It's not to exclude others. It's to recognize the differences between others. And so, I don't want to sound insensitive to people that wouldn't be involved in a father-daughter dance. If you're a traditional couple, a male-female couple, and you have three kids, but they're all boys, guess what? You don't get to participate in the father-daughter dance either. Although, a lot of the girls that may want to participate may not have fathers, and you might be asked to stand in, and that's a very common occurrence at these types of events, where other men will stand in as a father figure for girls that don't have a father so that they can experience the same lessons that you were talking about, Evan, at the beginning.
I want to tie this into another story that came out this week. This one from Ogden, Utah. There is a school that has a Valentine's Day dance, and the school didn't want the students to feel rejection, and so they have a policy at this dance. And I didn't understand this, but you said that this was an ongoing policy for their Valentine's Day dances, that if a boy asks a girl to dance, the girl can't say no, that she needs to have, I guess, like a sympathy dance with the boy, and that way the boy is protected from feeling rejection. And it was pointed out that just so happens, you know, this year at least, we're in the midst of this so-called hashtag Me Too movement, where women are being forced to do things that they don't want to do, and so it's just a really bad timing with this thing. But you know, I think that the story here is, I think it's better for our young people, our students, our children, to learn how to cope with rejection, not to avoid rejection. Boys learn a lot from being rejected in trying to talk to girls. You know, that's really a part of life. And that equips a boy in becoming a man of you know, as he pursues a wife someday, I suppose, that he's going to have to go through probably, you know, several experiences of rejection. And it's not doing the children any favor to try and put them in this bubble where they don't have to experience any rejection. But to, you know, okay, so she said no. Why'd she say no? What could you do differently? Or maybe there's other girls out there that would appreciate what you have to offer that she doesn't understand. And so there's things that you can teach kids about, you know, coping with rejection that would better equip them for life. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I definitely agree that the idea of avoiding rejection is a bad one. I think it's a
lost cause. I mean, it's going to happen, right?
It absolutely is. I can assure you. I think what they were after here, however misguided it may be, is probably more of avoiding a bullying situation. You know, there are certain students that become outcasts, ostracized, and they want these students to not have that repeated in this somewhat romantic situation. And I get the motivation. I just don't think that I agree with the method. Because I think it's more of a, again, I would liken it more to a bullying situation. In most cases, most kids, you know, you ask a few girls to dance, you finally find the one that will say yes. And there's something to that. There's, again, like you said, that you're learning from the rejections, and you're, you know, it's a point of growth. But also you're finding out who you have things in common with, it's kind of like today's modern, you know, online dating. And I hate to bring it up, but probably the best example of this would be with Tinder, where you're swiping left or right. And fortunately I've been married throughout the entire tech boom, so I haven't had to use online dating, but it's sort of a crude version of what dating life is kind of like, in that you find the type of women that are attracted to you, and you may find out that the ones that you thought you wanted to be with really aren't the ones that you fit best with. So it's a process that we all have to go through, and girls go through the same thing. I mean, especially in today's society, where it's not unusual for a girl to ask a boy out on a date. That was a little more rare when I was a kid, and probably a lot more rare when my parents were kids. But it's a process we need to go through. So while I get what they were probably aiming for here, and again, it was my understanding they've done this for a few years, I think it may be a little misguided.
Sure. And I think one of the biggest things that I think boys learn, and probably girls too, but I'm coming from the boys' perspective, the boys learn as they grow up and through adolescence and into adulthood, is that there's actual things to place high value on when seeking someone to date or potentially marry. And when you're in middle school, even high school, even in these days, college and post college, the things that you put high value on in looking for a mate are oftentimes things that really aren't things you should value in a spouse. So, I mean, obviously, when you're in middle school asking a girl to dance, you're not thinking, is this person going to be a good mother or something like that? And nor should that be a criteria. But oftentimes, boys are just asking the question, is this girl pretty? You know, am I attracted to her? And these things. And that's a fine criteria. Of course, their attraction needs to be an element of it. But there's a much more than just the physical appearance. And Jeff, I know that probably from your experience, I'm guessing here, you can resonate with this, that there's been times, you know, before we were both married, that maybe there was a girl that we were attracted to, and then upon getting to know her, we found that she wasn't really attractive at all.
Absolutely.
And I don't know if people think that guys are so shallow to only care about appearance. And really, most guys aren't. Most guys want a meaningful relationship. And maybe the physical appearance draws the initial interest, but upon getting to know the person, that attraction will fade quickly if the value actually isn't there. And that's something, again, to teach the children, to teach our young boys, to teach our high schoolers, and even our college students these days, too. And I think that those would be things that we would want to focus on, maybe from the perspective of families more than schools. But that's what we want to focus on in preparing our young people to find mates.
Yeah. And I mean, I can remember, I can recall even a grade school crush, and I didn't know the girl at all, really, at this point, and I thought she was the most beautiful creature there was, and I got her to talk to me, and she agreed to be my girlfriend. Now, remember, this is grade school, so that doesn't mean a whole lot, and she gave me her phone number, but she said not to call her over the weekend, and it was a strange thing, but of course, as this anxious boy that, you know, this girl actually just said, you know, she'd be my girlfriend. And so, of course, I called her. And so within the course of a 2-day weekend, I lost my first girlfriend very quickly because I didn't do what she was told. There was maybe a little foreshadowing there. But it was a learning experience, and it was. And I found out over the course of time, after being upset that I blew it so badly, as I got to know her a little more, I found out she was really kind of mean. And I was glad that didn't work out. And so you go through these situations. And so I think that it's important. Every one of those experiences kind of guides you into, you know, finding that person that becomes your partner for life. And I wouldn't trade those in. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't trade those in for a teacher telling a girl, now you have to say yes. Don't tell him no. It's not your fault that, you know, he's only 2 feet tall.
Well, one thing that's not being addressed here is, okay, we don't want the boy to experience rejection, but what is it doing for a boy to ask a girl to dance and she doesn't want to, but she has to say yes. So now they dance. What's going through the boy's mind at this point? He's thinking, oh, maybe she kind of likes me. She wanted to dance with me. Well, she was just saying yes to dance because she had to, because that was the school policy. Well, now that he's going to experience actually more rejection, thinking that there might be an attraction there versus saying, no, I don't want to dance with you. Well, that's a smaller rejection to deal with than a bigger rejection, thinking that there's maybe that some relationship might be coming. So,
yeah, I think the pain of the fifth grade girl hiding in the classroom from me because I had a big box of chocolates for her for Valentine's, while it was very painful at the time, it's an experience I needed to go through to understand what a male female relationship really was going to mean. And I may not have known it in that, you know, fifth grade class, but it definitely, I can still tell the story like it was yesterday. So clearly it has stuck with me. Yeah. And I've learned from it. So yeah, I think that giving that false hope is probably doing actually the opposite of what they think that they're accomplishing with that policy.
Right. Well, we need to take a break before we specialize in rejection. Stay tuned.
The phone lines are now open. Call toll free 1-844-51-FAITH. That's 1-844-51-FAITH.
With SRN News, I'm Rich Thomason in Washington. It was all over in just 6 minutes. Investigators in Florida say that's how long it took Nicholas Cruz to kill 17 people in the Parkland High School massacre. Last night, hundreds turned out for a candlelight vigil to honor and mourn the victims. He's trying for a political comeback. Republican Mitt Romney launching a U.S. Senate campaign in Utah. He made the announcement earlier today in an online video. Unable to agree on any of the competing proposals, the Senate failing to act on immigration reform, including a DACA fix. New home construction surged last month, up more than 9.5%. Stocks higher on Wall Street right now. The Dow is up about 84 points. The Nasdaq better by 21. More details at srnnews.com.
And now it's time for Table Talk Extras with Pastor Brian Wolf-Mueller.
The trick to being a good legalist is to take the rules and make them easy. Not too easy, but easy enough so that you can keep them, but hard enough so that hardly anybody can. But in your making the rules easier, you want to make it look like they're a lot more difficult, so that everyone else around you looks at you and says, "Wow, look at all those rules that they're keeping. Look at how good they are." You want to be able to keep the rules. That's the number one thing. But then you want everyone else to think that the rules are so difficult that they can't do it themselves. So that the legalist takes the law, and instead of using it to show their own sin, the legalist uses the law as a ruler to gauge how good they are in comparison to everyone else. Jesus isn't a legalist. He doesn't use the law to show how good he is. He takes the law all the way and shows how bad everyone else is. He uses the law properly so that we see in his using of the law that we are sinners and that we cannot save ourselves, that we need rescuing and delivering. And once we realize that, then Jesus comes to us to save us and rescue us from our sins. Jesus is the anti-legalist. He's the opposite of the legalist, and he doesn't come down harder on anyone more than the legalists, because he won't have it. Because by the law, no one is righteous. We are made righteous and holy and perfect only by the forgiveness of all of our sins, which comes to us through the same Jesus Christ our Lord.
This has been a production of Table Talk Radio. For more information, visit tabletalkradio.org.
This is Sacred Meditations. Christ, the life of all the living, Christ, the death of death our foe, who thyself for me once giving to the darkest depths of woe, through thy sufferings, death, and merit, I eternal life inherit. Thousand thanks shall be, dearest Jesus, unto thee. Thou hast taken on thee bonds and stripes, a cruel rod. Pain and scorn were heaped upon thee, O thou sinless Son of God. Thus didst thou my soul deliver from the bonds of sin forever. Thousand thanks shall be, dearest Jesus, unto thee. Thank you for making Sacred Meditations part of your prayer life for this season of Lent.
And we're back. You're on Once for All. Well, this is one story among many. Headline from the Washington Post says, clergy gather to bless one of the only U.S. clinics performing late-term abortions. This is just a sickening article where there's a group of clergy from various religions blessing the abortion clinic and even going through a ceremonial rite and consecrating the abortion clinic's rooms, and just sickening as I even talk about it. And this is just one of many stories. This is actually becoming a notable thing of many clergy doing this. And but this is, repulsive on different levels. I mean, it's repulsive just the fact that you have clergy who are, you know, claiming to be Christian in some of these cases, and who should have a voice against the tragedy that is occurring in these clinics, that say, look, I don't know. I mean, you don't even have to be religious. You just have to have a brain to say, look, I don't think we should be killing people's children. That I don't think that that's fundamentally right. That's not a good thing to do. But what makes it even worse is to say that now they're blessing it or consecrating it. They're somehow, which is supposed to be something that's set aside for God's holy use, God's holy purpose. So they're saying that God's holy purpose is to kill unborn children. This is just incredibly shocking. Now, I have a connection to this with a passage from the Old Testament, but Jeff, I want to get your take or input on this story first. What do you think about these clergy blessing late-term abortion clinics?
Yeah, I don't get it. I can't understand how they've singled out the clinics that perform late-term abortions over maybe other clinics. And now, I can't speak from a religious perspective on this, but it seems to me that if you're reaching out to the women involved, that they're making a tough decision. I have a friend who has I hate this term, but I guess it's the proper term, has a ministry of counseling women that have had abortions in their past. And I think it's a noble cause. And I think that there's some people out there that are hurting that need that. But this isn't what we're talking about here. We're talking about the women that are deciding, making that decision to terminate their own baby. And not only that, but they're singling out clinics that do late term abortion, which is now from your and I's perspective, it really doesn't matter whether it's early term or late term. We're against abortion in any form. But if you take it from the secular point of view of for years, one of the arguments has always been viability. Well, if it's a late term of abortion, the viability claim doesn't even hold up. So I can't understand how any clergy would want to be involved in this. And again, if you're blessing the women for this tough time in life, I guess someone could say, well, you know, it's not Christian of you to ignore those women. Well, yeah, but we shouldn't be celebrating their sin either.
Right.
We've had discussions about, you know, transgenders and homosexuality and gay wedding and all of that. And my fallback has always been it's one thing to accept someone for their inclinations to sin and to try and help them and if they really want to not be a sinner, it's another thing to celebrate mental illness or celebrate sinful behavior. And that's what we're being asked to do. And now we have these clergy participating in that. I don't get it at all.
Yeah. Now at our congregation, we have a ladies' Bible study on Thursdays at 10. And we just yesterday we're studying Jeremiah. And just yesterday we came across a text that I think parallels this, in, I think, a quite amazing way. The Lord had judgment against Judah and Israel because that they were, he said, bringing things detestable into his house. Now that we made a distinction between something that's profane and something that's detestable, the Lord has a place like the temple that is sacred, and something that's sacred means it's set apart. One of the examples I almost always use in talking about something being sacred is it's like if you inherit your great grandma's fine china set, and so you're probably going to put this in a special case, and you're never going to take it out except for maybe like Christmas dinner or dinner with the president or whatever, very special occasions. When, Sunday afternoon when you're watching the Broncos and you're having chili dogs, you're probably not going to pull out the fine china set to have your chili dogs on. They're set apart for a special use. And that's what sacred means, something set apart to be special. So that the Lord had set apart his temple to be a special place. It's different from everything else. Now, everything else is called profane, not like profane words, but common, ordinary. So we don't want the ordinary things to come into the sacred place because then it ruins its sacredness. But then there's detestable things. Detestable things aren't just things that are common, but they're things that are against the sacred. So like if you brought a goat into the the temple without the proper procedures, I suppose that would be bringing something profane. But if you took a pig and slaughtered a pig inside the temple, now that's detestable because pigs are considered unclean. Okay, so what happened in Jeremiah was that the Lord was condemning them for bringing detestable things in the house. They were bringing the worship of Molech, and this was a false god to which they sacrificed their sons and daughters to. They were sacrificing sons and daughters to this god, but what was worse, they weren't just doing this somewhere. What's worse is they brought this worship of Molech into the temple. So this place that is supposed to be holy for God is now being profaned, and with, or not even profaned, detested with this worship of Molech and sacrificing sons and daughters. Now, I read this story, and here you have clergy who are supposed to be speaking forth the things of God, and they're performing a ceremony of consecration, which is supposed to set things apart from God's sacred use. But what they're using that sacred ceremony for is to consecrate something that is detestable to the Lord, the murder of unborn children. And I mean, the wrath of God in the Old Testament should scare us a little bit when we read stories like this. That was a long explanation, but I don't know if you have anything you want to comment on this story at all, but we have about 2 or 3 minutes left.
Yeah, and there's not a lot I can add to that. This is more in this is your department for sure. but yeah, I find it, to use one of your words, I find it detestable. That they would participate in this. I don't have too much else to say. The one little thing I would touch on that you mentioned is in the example you were giving about the fine china and whatever. Mm-hmm. I would say that if the Broncos actually make it back to the Super Bowl, I think you should get out your fine china.
So cheap shot. Ouch. that would hurt.
That's
would
okay. Hurt. If the Raiders make it back, I'll have to get out my grandmother's fine china.
I don't think a Raiders fan ought to be poking fun right now. I don't know about that. Well, obviously, I think maybe a concluding thought on this story is that what we expect of Christians in general, but pastors especially, is to defend life, right? Part of the problem with the slave trade that we had in our country is that there was a certain criteria that was set up by those in power, I suppose, that that made a definition of what does not constitute life, or what does not constitute human rights. And so those who were sold into slavery did not reach that definition, so they did not deserve the same rights as others. And if we really boil down what's going on with the abortion epidemic, we have, for the sake of our own agendas, career paths, money, or just our sexual behavior, we've made a definition for life that the baby in the womb does not fit. And so now we think that we have a particular power over this non-life because it doesn't fit our definition. But this is why not even just Christians, people assert that we ought to define just the mere existence of a person to be the definition of life deserving those rights. And so we can't come to some kind of a stage of viability because that's subjective. We can't, make on the basis of inside the womb or outside the womb because that's just geography. The only moment that we can say with certainty that a life is a life is that it exists and no other criteria must be met. I'll give you the last 30 seconds.
Well, I would just challenge the listener, and I think most of our listeners probably generally agree with our take on abortion, but I know we have some that don't. We've gotten some letters of people challenging our beliefs. So I would challenge you to come up with, why is abortion a religious argument? I don't think it should be at all. I think that the common sense of it speaks for itself. We use a lot of religious arguments to make our case. I don't think being against abortion is a religious argument at all, and I would challenge our listeners to, send us a letter. Let us know why you think that it's okay on for forget the religion.
This has been Once for All. You can contact the show by sending an email, deliveredonceforall@gmail.com. You can listen again to this show or any other episodes by visiting onceforallradio.com. Until next time, stand firm in the faith, once delivered to the saints.